This week on Making Contact.
This is not a smart bomb. This is a net, a dragnet over 450 blocks, where any young person who the police officer thinks might be affiliated and they happen to be wearing red, they can be classified and entered in this database.
It's called a gang injunction, a controversial crime-fighting tool that some people say should be illegal, and others say is a necessary last resort for communities plagued by violence.
There is no constitutional right by a gang member to come together, associate with others, to commit crimes.
On this edition, we go from the birthplace of gang injunctions in Los Angeles to their newest use in London, England. Almost 30 years later, communities remain divided about the best way to address youth violence and crime. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. It's a sunny June morning in Oakland, California. There's still 2 weeks until school lets out, but instead of sitting in class talking about their summer plans, the kids at Santa Fe Elementary School are marching through the neighborhood calling for peace. City and state budget cuts mean fewer summer jobs and youth programs, which equal more teenagers without activities to keep them out of trouble. This in a year that's already seen more murders than in 2010.
Getting hurt, walking down the street, walking home from school, walking to school and stuff.
We gotta stop the fighting, like a shooting and people just killing each other.
And gangs. I see people getting shot every single day. We need more cops in the city.
I don't wanna like go outside or nothing because it'll be heck of violence outside.
This should not be happening. Everybody shooting each other. That is not nice.
As more than 200 children march through the streets of North Oakland, cars honk and people wave. Anyone who lives around here knows that violent crime has long been a problem. Kwame Natoto directs parent education at a group called Oakland Parents Together.
This is the worst I've ever seen in terms of the murder rate with young kids and just the violence and the lack of understanding around human values.
As in many urban areas, much of the violence in North Oakland is committed by young men of color. And, as is often the case, there's a public debate raging about how to solve the problem. One part of the city attorney's solution was to get a judge to issue something called a gang injunction. Here's Rosio Fierro, an attorney for the city of Oakland, explaining what a gang injunction is.
The gang injunctions are what we would call protective orders. When there is a spouse that is abused by another spouse, they have the right to go and seek a protective order. And they do so in order to protect their safety and their home and their children. In this case, these protective orders are for the community.
So in this case, the injunction is designed to protect the people of North Oakland. Santa Fe Elementary School is smack dab in the middle of a 100-block area that, as of June 2010, was designated a safety zone. 15 suspected local gang members have been put on a list approved by a judge, and inside that safety zone, their rights are restricted. They aren't allowed to go out after 10 p.m. or associate with each other at any time of day. A violation of those rules could mean up to 6 months in jail. Police say injunctions are necessary to help fight crime, and many residents support the idea. But many other Oaklanders disagree, saying those restrictions are a violation of basic civil rights, and point out that the people on the list don't have to have been proven guilty of any crime. And once you're on the list, it's very difficult to get your name taken off. They also say the injunctions allow police to racially profile, since most of those on the list are Black and Latino, and police can stop those on the list at will.
We believe they are criminalizing our youth, they are profiling our youth, they are leading to complete harassment of our communities.
Cesar Cruz works with the Homies Empowerment Program, which brings together youth from rival gangs to learn about their cultures. He lives in an East Oakland neighborhood called Fruitvale. After North Oakland, the Oakland City Attorney targeted the Fruitvale neighborhood with the city's second gang injunction in early 2011. This one targeting a street gang called the Norteños. Cruz points out that Oakland has spent more than $1 million on the North Oakland and Fruitvale injunctions, much of it fighting lawsuits by those on the injunction list.
This funding that is being wasted by the city attorney could be going to after-school programs that can have a PM service till 10 o'clock in the evening.
The city of Oakland already spends more than 65% of its annual budget on the police and fire departments. Meanwhile, the school board has begun action on a plan to close more than 30 public schools in the next few years. Sagnite Salazar is an organizer with Youth Together, a group that runs youth centers and various programs addressing violence and conditions in the schools.
Oakland has over a 50% dropout rate and under a 50% graduation rate because our adults in this city are choosing to prioritize band-aid solutions that ostracize our community and criminalize our young people and demonize our young people for the issues that this city chooses not to address.
Salazar was one of dozens of volunteers who organized a week of gang injunctions teach-ins at schools throughout the city.
Basically today, we're just going to talk about the gang injunctions and, you know, the technicalities of it and how it affects all of us. How many of y'all heard about the gang injunctions? You?
A local hip-hop MC who goes by KEV is speaking to a class at Youth Empowerment School, not far from the proposed Fruitvale Injunction Safety Zone.
Okay, raise your hand if you know someone who's been killed by the police.
Well, Oscar Grant.
And they don't go to jail for it. They never go to jail.
Raise your hand if you know somebody was shot by the police or the police pulled a gun out on them or something.
Many of the kids here know people who might end up on the injunction list. In addition to 40 named individuals, that list includes 70 John Does. Those are open slots where police can add someone to the list after the fact if they decide they are a gang member. Danielle Roca is a senior at Youth Empowerment School.
I'm one of those people that live in that Fruitvale area, and like I wear red all the time. Like, you can't just tell me just because I'm wearing a color that I'm representing a gang. So I have a strong possibility of being on that list, so I don't feel that that's acceptable because I have, like, my life ahead of me. I'm going to college, and, like, you can't just tell me that just because I'm in a certain place at a certain time that I'm representing a gang.
Students like Roca were among several hundred that marched to City Hall to protest the Fruitvale injunction.
Stop the gang injunction! We know our rights! Stop the gang injunction! We know our rights!
After months of similar protests, the city council agreed to hold a public hearing and determine whether to continue funding gang injunctions. While the creation of the injunctions themselves were decided by the city attorney, if the council pulled funding, the injunctions would basically be dead in the water. In May of 2011, hundreds packed an Oakland City Council meeting to make their voices heard on the Fruitvale injunction. Rosie Fierro, an attorney for the city of Oakland, made the case.
Restraining orders that this city has pursued are based on civil rights. It is indeed this gang's and its members who violate the civil rights of residents in these areas. There is no constitutional right by a gang member to come together, associate with others, to commit crimes.
One city council member played a recording of a voicemail a Fruitvale resident left him.
I know that my family does not want me to open my mouth or get involved, but I have to. Everybody in this neighborhood is scared. The people next door don't even open up their shades.
Scott Peterson with the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce also spoke about how Oakland's high crime rate was an obstacle for efforts to create jobs.
Trying to attract businesses and trying to keep businesses in Oakland is a major problem because of public safety. If we want jobs, if we want to create revenue to fund the programs that support youth, that support alternatives to violent activity, violent criminal activity, we need to do more to attract business, to retain business, to create jobs for these young people.
But the vast majority of public comments were opposed to an injunction in Fruitvale. Even people on the injunctions list came out to plead with the city council to take a different course. Michael Muskin was one of them.
I'm just surprised about why am I on the list, because my last conviction was 5 years ago. And I haven't been violated probation. I'm just really stressed out because I live in the heart of the injunction. you look at the map, it's like a big circle around my house. So basically, I can't go anywhere between those specific times. I go to the gym when I get out of work. So sometimes I go about 11:30, 12. So if this does pass, where am I supposed to go? I live in Oakland. I don't got the money to move to the suburbs. I wish I did, but I don't.
In the end, despite overwhelming public comment in opposition, the council voted 4-3 to continue funding the injunctions. Most frustrating of all for anti-injunction activists was the decision came in spite of an admission by Oakland Police Lieutenant Freddie Hamilton that there wasn't much evidence the injunction in North Oakland was working.
As far as the effect on crime that the injunction has had to this point, I believe that we need more time to analyze that more thoroughly.
6 months later, in November 2011, a report from the Oakland Police Department found no reduction in violent crime in the so-called safety zone. In fact, those crimes had increased. Legendary activist Angela Davis, who's lived in Oakland for almost 40 years, says political will is hard to come by when it comes to fighting crime.
We know that any person who wants to get elected to office, if that person does not appear to be, quote, tough on crime, unquote, it will be very difficult. So I think it's up to us to build the kinds of movements that will empower people to stand up and demand education instead of incarceration.
And what do you say to people who want results now? Education takes a while.
You can't get results now. It's not possible. We have to think of long-range solutions. And if we want immediate results now, let's have an immediate overhaul of our educational system. Let's support teachers more than we support police. There will be some immediate results.
Gang injunctions are most widely used in California, but they've also divided communities across the country, from Florida to Minnesota to Texas. They've been challenged in court and, for the most part, ruled as legal. But the debate about their fairness and effectiveness remains unsettled ever since the first injunction was issued back in the 1980s in Los Angeles. To get some perspective, we spoke to Kim McGill. She's an organizer with the Youth Justice Coalition in L.A. We called her to get a sense of the history and what effect gang injunctions have had there over the years.
In the early 80s, 82, 83, the first injunctions were put in place in the far east part of L.A. County, the West Covina and Pomona area. And that pretty much set the trend for gang injunctions across the county in a really important way to this day, which is that they weren't so much placed in communities that were experiencing high levels of violence, but were first placed in communities that were either majority white or bordering white communities. So they've always been a tool of protecting white communities and or kind of paving the way for gentrification. The first gang injunction to get national attention was in 1987 against the Playboy Gangster Crips, and it was brought by then City Attorney Hahn, who later became Mayor Hahn. And he was a really suppression-oriented city attorney and mayor, and kind of put gang injunctions on the map. The thing that's interesting about Playboy Gangster Crips is, again, it was not the neighborhood in L.A. that was experiencing the highest levels of violence. That was always in other areas of South Central L.A., but Playboy Gangster Crips was chosen really as the first neighborhood because it bordered Culver City, which is a wealthier white community, majority white community, and was the neighborhood closest to Beverly Hills.
And so what do these neighborhoods look like today, especially those that started off in the 80s or early 90s? In what way have the injunctions helped or hurt? What effect have they had?
So I can't talk about, we have massive numbers of injunctions in L.A. City and in L.A. County. In L.A. City alone, we have 71 neighborhoods included on 43 injunctions. So I'm not pretending to say that I can describe every single neighborhood, but I can give you a couple of examples. When you look at what's really decreased homicide, the areas that had either no homicides or huge reduction in homicides and other forms of violence in the last 2 years were the areas that had youth development programs. There's a new program created out of the mayor's office and city council called the Gang Reduction Youth Development Program that included a project called Summer Night Lights in parks, particularly targeting playgrounds where there's been a lot of violence and or public housing where there's been a lot of violence. In the area of the district that had summer night lights, there were no homicides. In the area just blocks away where there was not summer night lights, you had, continued to see homicide rates. The other thing that we see is that the stabilization that injunctions promise communities actually has the opposite effect. So with people cycling in and out of jail constantly, in and out of juvenile hall in some cases constantly, they lose employment. You know, you could tell your employer once or twice that the police are harassing you and you're being unfairly targeted. But after a while, employers just don't believe that, particularly with the kind of assumptions that are made around people that have convictions. If people are in community college or a college, they lose too many school days of school and they have to drop out. They lose their financial aid. If you're in public housing or have Section 8, the federal statute is very clear that you can be kicked out of your public housing, and in fact, your whole family can be kicked out, even with an arrest, not with a conviction. So we have people that have actually beaten their cases and won their gang injunction case, but their family or them have already been evicted from public housing. So all of these impacts really destabilize communities. I think the most glaring statistics is we have a multi-billion-dollar war on gangs here in L.A. That's been going again ever since the late 70s. And yet, since we started, we have at least twice as many alleged gang members and six times as many alleged gangs as when the war started. And so no one would consider that a success, that the problem's only grown huge amounts since that kind of an investment in suppression.
That was Kim McGill, an organizer with the Youth Justice Coalition in Los Angeles. You can hear an extended interview with her at our website, radioproject.org. Coming up in a minute, we look at just how far gang injunctions have spread, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. We'll be right back.
It wouldn't amaze me 'cause my color is death, though we all want peace, but our war won't end till all wars cease.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Just as New York City's broken windows crime-fighting philosophy has been exported around the world, the idea of gang injunctions is beginning to make its way overseas. Their first stop is England. Making Contact reporter Daniel Gordon filed this report from London, where the first gang injunctions went into effect in early 2011. He found that economics and race are major factors in how society treats crime in England, just as in the U.S. And just like in Oakland, many advocates and young people themselves say there are better solutions to be found.
And this one's called Letter to the Dead. And I got a bag of letters left on my dresser. I just can't find the right postcode.
My gang injunction just to not rap about certain things and to not walk with more than three people. Like, that's not doing anything to help anyone, because I could still do crime if I wanted to. I could just do it by myself. So me, them giving me a gang injunction saying I can't rap is stupid.
This is a letter to the dead. How does it feel on the other side?
It's working. The person's not been involved in any other kind of activity. He has made a change, and he's made a positive change for himself, and all credit to him for doing
that's
that.
That's why I'm writing this letter, so you can write back so I can tell another brother to stop.
Two contrasting views of the British-style gang injunction. You heard first from an 18-year-old rapper who, in March of 2011, was the first person in the country to receive a gang injunction. Then from the man whose office asked a court to issue the order. The rapper, who doesn't want his identity revealed, is forbidden from meeting with more than two people at a time in his neighbourhood and from walking down certain streets. He's also banned from recording songs or videos deemed to encourage violence. Amongst the other possible sanctions that courts can order are a ban on wearing particular colours that might identify someone as a gang member. Jonathan Toy, head of community safety at Southwark Council, the borough the rapper lives in, insists the injunctions aren't designed to punish.
So the injunctions we're looking to put in are to put support mechanisms in, whether it be about mentoring or whether it be about access to other types of activity or engagement in certain things. They form part of the injunction. That's what makes them very special. And if they're focused at the people who we believe we can help and support through that and use the enforcement as a backdrop to it, then they can be effective. And that's what we found with our injunction.
Statistics about gangs here are hard to come by. Bill Bratton, the former LA and New York police chief, who's now advising the British government, has called the UK's gang problem gestational compared to the US. There have been a high number of stabbings and shootings amongst young people in recent years, though the extent of gang involvement is unclear. What's for sure is that the infrastructure designed to tackle youth violence is under threat. Emeka Ebwanu is a youth worker at the Crib Youth Project across town in Hackney. What does he make of the idea of gang injunctions?
Did that?
Yeah. I don't think that solution is effective because it's tackling the characteristics of what happens in gangs instead of actually tackling the actual issues, you know, that lead young people to feel like, you know, they need to find solace within the gang.
Such as what? What do you mean when you say that the issues that make people want to be in gangs?
Inequality, the lack of education or being kicked out of school at a young age, you know, so for instance, a young person who might have been disruptive because maybe he couldn't read properly or write properly, but the way he feels he can vent his frustration is by lashing out. And so, you know, the school feels like, you know what, he's disrupting the learning of other people, which is fair enough, but then by kicking him out of school, you're socially excluding him. And so he's more likely to now end up in the prison system, which is more of a problem to the community later on. So let's deal with the issue when, you know, when it's still small, before we let it fester.
The Crib is a community centre for young people thought to be at risk of offending and of joining gangs. Those who use it are from underprivileged backgrounds, the majority of them black. The Crib users I met were unwilling to talk to me on the record, all except for one.
Hello, my name is Michael Bailey. I just grew up in the area. I knew about the Crib because it was just a place we could actually get away from all of the negative feedbacks, I guess.
He says the centre has given him a sense of belonging he couldn't find anywhere else.
There's not many places we can actually go and say what's on our mind and what we think, but Crib's a place we can actually go and do that. Do you know what I'm saying? They actually listen to us. Our words actually mean something in Crib. Do you know what I mean?
As well as a drop-in youth centre, the Crib also provides guidance and training and has helped Michael Bailey set up on his own, editing videos.
It's about, you know, getting young people and helping moving them forward and shaping their minds. And that's what we try to do because we work actively with the police in different workshops. We have a workshop we call Trading Places, which is where the police come in and we have a session with them and the young people, and they have a role reversal and role playing so they can understand each other's roles within the community. And these are the things that we do to try to bridge the gap.
Like many social services across the country, the Crib is falling victim to cuts in funding. It's already lost 75% of its income, and the future is uncertain. Restrictions in money for youth services have been widely blamed for helping set the scene for riots in the summer of 2011 that started in London and quickly spread across the country.
Hi, I'm Russell Higgs. I've lived on the Pembury estate for about 16 years.
The social housing estate where Russell Higgs lives, the Pembury, is also in Hackney, a couple of miles north of the Crib. The area became a front line in the summer's disturbances, with locals' shops looted by crowds, fights between police and rioters, and vehicles set on fire.
One of the worst things that I saw occur was we had a lot of diverted buses coming down this road, dumping people off, so literally a crowd was being created.
Once calm had been restored, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced an all-out war on gangs. Gang injunctions are likely to be amongst the weaponry he uses, although the legislation that brought them to the UK was actually passed before the trouble started. but it's never been proven that gangs were behind the riots at all, and the most up-to-date research commissioned by the government suggests they weren't.
Were the riots gangs, or were the riots just groups of alienated youths? I mean, who's to say whether it's just groups of individuals or what, you know?
For the purposes of a gang injunction, a gang is defined as three people or more.
All I can say from my experience is that I have teenage boys primarily congregating outside my front door quite regularly. I have done for years. And I've always been civil with them. And I find that they're civil with me, really. You know, that's my experience. But I'm very much aware that some of my neighbours do feel intimidated by teenagers hanging out. But my impression is that they're not responding to the actual teenagers themselves. They're filtering them through a negative sort of mediated story about teenagers. And they're not bothering to engage with these individuals.
Back at the crib, Michael Bailey and Emeka Ebwanu agree with Russell Higgs that groups of young friends are often wrongly labelled as gangs, and they think that gang injunctions are likely to make things worse still.
Many times I've walked down the street with 15 or more people from my football team, do you understand? We might be coming from a match or something, might get stopped from the police. So now that's classed as a gang. That does not make sense to me.
It all depends on perception and what a gang is, really. And so out here, sometimes they might see some young people, you know, just play fighting or just messing about with each other. But people looking from the high rises or tower blocks who call the police 9 times out of 10 because they think there's a big sort of gang warfare going on downstairs. But when the police come, it might just be, you know, childish or just teenage, being adolescents, just being young.
With gangs so high up on the government's hit list, it's perhaps surprising that so few gang injunctions have been issued, just a handful in the course of 2011. One senior official told me, off the record, that the costs involved in getting courts to issue them were a major disincentive for local city governments and for the police. Jonathan Toy, though, says there's another side to the financial argument.
If it protects our community, then I think it's money very well worth spent. We have to remember that if a young person loses their life, the cost of that to us and the society and the criminal justice system is around about $1.8-1.9 million. It's a huge sum of money.
Gang injunctions are too new and still too unfamiliar in the UK for any definitive conclusions to be drawn about them yet. They may well be seen as an increasingly attractive option by a government that's cutting back on funding for social services at a time when it's determined to show a less tolerant approach to youth violence. Michael Bailey has his own recipe for keeping young people on the straight and narrow.
Simple. Help these people to be occupied. And that's my answer. Do you know what I mean? If this direct person's trouble, then find him something where he's occupied, you know what I mean?
For Making Contact, I'm Daniel Gordon in London.
Everybody wants to say they're a gangster till they get stabbed up. Feds put me in them handcuffs.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. This program was crowdfunded on Spot Us. Thanks to everyone who donated to make community-supported journalism possible. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.